This is my first time telling my story, so please bear with me. My sobriety date is August 4th, 2020. So I've got a little over a year. Currently, I attend 4 to 5 meetings a week. 4 is my commitment. One of them is a men's black belt meeting. So we have commitments that we have to make. My home group is the Riverside on Bayshore, Wednesday nights. I have 2 sponsees that I work with, and I talk with my sponsor. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. My story really begins with my first drink, probably in 7th grade. There was a party out in the woods, and I had my first beer, and I liked it. That was it. You know, it kind of moved on to high school. I didn't really drink much until I got into high school. I went to a Catholic school, all guys. And on the weekends, I would meet up with some of the older guys, some of the seniors that were in my neighborhood, and we'd go out and drink, and I still liked it. We'd go to dances and drink before the dance, and it made it easier to talk to the ladies and the women and go dancing with them. By the time I got into college, I was studying chemical engineering, and for the first year and a half, I was spending a lot of time studying, but wanting to have that whole party experience. I was doing pretty well in school, but I wasn't getting like straight A's or anything like that, and I was kind of like, why am I busting my butt? I see all these other people out there having fun. I'm not having fun. I'm supposed to have fun. I'm in college. So I joined a fraternity, and I had tons of fun with that. Through there, I moved into the frat house. You know, we would drink Thursday through Sunday every weekend. During the week, we mostly just sat around, smoked weed, dropped out of chemical engineering. You know, that wasn't going to last while living that type of lifestyle. So I got a degree in resource economics. People ask me what that is. I look at a tree and I see the economic value in it. And that's what I did. But, you know, with that, I learned how to program computers. You know, while I was in chemical engineering, that was part of it. So I kind of used that when I got into the workforce. But, you know, going through college, you know, I would black out sometimes, but most of the time we would just drink and drink and drink, and I could never just have one or two and stop. Some of the people I would with, we'd be able to go out like for a Saturday afternoon, watch some college football, they'd just have a couple of beers, go back, do their thing. At that point, once I had one, I was going to drink for the rest of the night. And so I never recognized that as a problem. I just thought, you know, okay, I'm in college, I'll just keep going. When I graduated college, got a job, at that point, I knew I couldn't drink like I was in school. We kind of, all of us, we kind of like settled down a little bit. Still went out on Thursdays, but we would go out late enough, and then we'd have to go back, you know, we'd have to get home to go to work the next day, so we never really got too out of control, but Friday and Saturday was just total weekend warrior, raging however we could. And that went on through my 20s. And then into my 30s, I got a job with IBM. It was right after I moved down here in 2005. I got a job with IBM that they would fly me all around the country to do work. So it was at that time where I would get sent to different places. You get layovers in the airports, and you look around, there's a bar. You know, it's Thursday at 3 o'clock, you might as well just start drinking. And because I was flying so much, I would always sit in first class, and they're just handing you beer. So by the time I get home Thursday night, just totally trashed. Thank God for the taxi cabs there at the airport. And so that started. And then, you know, yeah, during the week, you get the per diem. So instead of eating, I was starting to drink. So I started drinking daily at this point. I could no longer white knuckle it Monday through Wednesday just to get to Thursday to have that drink. I couldn't keep it under control. So after about 5 or 6 years of that, I got a job locally here in Tampa. But I couldn't give up the daily drinking anymore. So I was drinking every day. I was just waiting for 5 o'clock to come and I would start drinking. And I tried quitting at that point, tried controlled drinking and things of that. None of it was working. And then things happened at my job where they kind of moved a whole bunch of the section of the project that I was working on. They moved it over to Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was the only one left here in Tampa. And so I was just working from home. And then at that point, I started drinking at lunch. I was like, okay, I'll go have a couple of beers at lunch, go back to work, finish up. No one's going to know. I'm sitting at my house by myself. And, you know, that kept going for another 3 or 4 years. And eventually it just started, I just started waking up and having to have a beer. I had the shakes so bad that I couldn't keep myself under control without having a drink. But amazingly, I could keep my job. I don't know how I did it. I've never really had any consequences up until this point. I was just living. I still had my car, had a house, I'm married. Nothing was falling apart, so I never looked to try and fix anything. And then it kind of got bad, so I decided that I needed to get a job where I would have to go to the office and at least be accountable that way. You know, okay, that'll shut down the day, you know, the morning drink. But after about 6 months of that, I was just having to have a drink before I would go into the office, just so that way I wasn't shaking when I get there. Wait for lunch, run to lunch, have a couple beers, get back to work, wait till 5 o'clock, hit the first gas station out of the office parking lot and start drinking and just keep going. And that was pretty much my life for the next few years. Funny thing, you hear people tell that they would hide beers or drink from other people. I actually had the opposite, where my wife would take my full beers and hide them, but I would just go out and get more anyway. And then all of a sudden I would find them in a closet. I would go, oh wow, look at this, another little 12 pack for myself. But yeah, so that was my problem. Through this, I was extremely self-centered and egotistical. I thought I knew what I was doing, you know, and I could just drink and nothing was gonna happen to me and all of this, until something did happen. And then it was in 2020, right about the time COVID started hitting, like right around March. I started puking up blood, and I was rushed to the hospital at that time. And I had to get blood transfusion, so I had internal bleeding in my GI tract. And at that point, it was kind of scary, because no, they wouldn't let anyone come visit me because of the whole COVID thing that was going on. So I was in the ICU all by myself, just sitting there getting blood transfusions, pumping other chemicals into my body, other fluids and stuff like that. You know, and the doctor tells me you have to quit drinking. But this is how good of an alcoholic I was. Somehow, when I went there, I actually convinced someone to bring in a beer for me. While I'm hooked up to all these IVs, I got a 16-ounce Bud Light, and I was able to drink it in the ICU. That is a true story. That's how bad I got. So at that point, you know, the doctor's like, you need help. He goes, you're gonna die if you continue. And I'm like, yeah. When can I get out of here? So I get out. I get out and I try and quit drinking for, you know, 3 weeks I lasted. And then I was like, that doctor doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. So I start drinking again. And a month later, I'm in the ICU again for the same exact reason. And I isolated by myself in there because no one can come visit me because COVID's still going on. And all I wanted to do was get out. I didn't want to drink, but I just wanted to get out of there. And so they wanted to keep me there and do more tests and everything, and I was like, no, I'm out. So I finally got out after about 3 days. And at that point, I'm like, okay, I think I need to do something. And I was thinking, oh, I'll try and go to church, try and get in touch with God. I mean, I had the whole Catholic school background, so I was thinking I could go that way. Never made it there. And about a month later, me and my wife had a fight, and I got drunk, and I was gonna get a place at the beach and stay away for a week, but I ended up getting a car accident, a DUI. I ended up getting Baker acted, and I had to stay there for three days. I met a guy that was in the program, and he was talking to me. And at that point, when I was sitting there for those 3 days, I realized I needed a change. And so I listened to that guy, and by the time I was ready to get discharged from there, I was ready to find out what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. I got out. Now I had to explain to work and everything, so it took me about a week, but I ended up going to a meeting a week after I got out, and it was at Riverside, and I met Bobby, who you'll hear from, and she told me I had to do 90 and 90, so I did that. And then as I started going through this, my whole thought was just to quit drinking, but what I quickly realized was that Alcoholics Anonymous is really a way to change your life. While I was in active addiction, I would walk around irritated, disgruntled, just thinking everybody was stupid and didn't know what they were doing and I had all the answers and things like that. But what I soon realized was that it was me and that I needed to change my perspective in life. And just the simplest thing for me was the Serenity Prayer. As soon as I applied that to my life, whenever I felt a little bit of discomfort, just saying the Serenity Prayer gave me calm and peace at that moment. And it's at that point, and then I continued on with step three and really understanding what it meant to turn my life over to God and my will. Not expecting outcomes, not trying to control situations and manipulate people in situations for the outcome that I desire, but instead just focus on what I can control and then let God handle the rest. And with that, in this short time, I know AA, from an AA perspective, I was just a pile of mush there, but I'm starting to, with AA and working the steps, working with other alcoholics, I find myself forming, you know, kind of taking that clump of goo and turning it into a human, and take a human form. And at some point, I'm hoping that it will be complete, but I know it's a lifelong journey, and the amount of progress I feel that I've made in the short term, there's much more growth to go. And I don't know if anybody's out there that deals with problems and projects, but they always say 80% of it's for the last 20%. And, you know, I'm not near that last 20% yet, but I continue to look forward to going to AA meetings and being a part of the community and the fellowship. And with that, I'm good.
Thank you, Brian. Our group has asked Bobby Lynn to be our main speaker tonight.
All right, I'm Bobby, and I'm an alcoholic. I really do enjoy doing my story. I know a lot of people don't like to get up here, and it doesn't really make any sense to me. I mean, I can talk about myself all day. Talking about myself is like my third favorite thing to do, and especially when it gets later in the evening. You know, I get like that late night zoomies, and I just like can't stop talking. I talk the most. But so I will stop actually in 45 minutes. Don't worry. So I never know how to start these things, so I just kind of jump right into it. So I was born in Baltimore, Maryland. I have three older sisters. Two of them are significantly older. They're from my mom's previous marriage, so they're kind of like pseudo-moms as well. And then I have another sister that's a year older than me, hence why my name is Bobby. My dad is a Robert, and he really wanted a boy, and he got me instead. That's a little annoying when you're a kid. You know, little kids can be so cruel, but I appreciate it now. We moved out of Baltimore pretty early. I was in first grade, and we moved into the suburbs in southern Maryland. And it was a really nice neighborhood area, except if you really wanted to get anywhere or do anything. It was all those subdivisions that crashed in 2008, like those big houses and stuff like that. They all had like those tree names or apple names and stuff like that. So that's where I grew up. I had like on the outside like a very normal family and a very normal childhood, but that was, you know, kind of the point. My parents are both like high functioning alcoholics, although the high functioning kind of wavered a little bit there. Sometimes it was high functioning. They were the kind of parents, you know, my sister would have to come get us from the Taco Bell drive-thru because they passed out drunk in the driver's seat. You know, but then the next day, like, you know, their parent of the year taking you to like softball practice and all this stuff and like doing events and stuff like that. It was kind of hit or miss, and it made me into like a really anxious kid. I was always terrified of when like that other shoe was going to drop, you know. It made me really hyper aware of like people's attitudes when they were around me, because I was trying to protect myself of when, you know, somebody was going to flip out. And I spent a lot of time under my bed. You know, I had like a little like fortress under there, and I would just be under there pretty much like all day reading. And it was the only safe place that I really had. We were in a big neighborhood out in the middle of nowhere. You couldn't really go do anything, so I would just hide there. You know, otherwise, like, my childhood, I never wanted for anything. I had everything that I could possibly need, you know, except maybe some unconditional love, you know, a hug. You know, like stuff like that, you know. You know, as I grew up, relatively normal, by the time I got to middle school, I think I was about 12 years old, I know now that I ended up developing very severe depression very early on. And I know what it is now, but at the time, like, I didn't have anybody to talk to. I didn't know how to explain whatever was going on with me. So it was just something that I had to live with. And it made me isolate terribly. I didn't talk to anybody. I faked sick to get out of school just about every day. My parents thought there was something legit wrong with me. As much as I faked sick, I got really good at it. But I just could not stand to be around people. I just felt so terrible all the time. I don't remember the first time that I drank alcohol. Being in an alcoholic family, it was just always there. My dad owned a bar before I was born. My grandmother worked in one up until the day she died. And so I grew up playing in bars. You know, in downtown Baltimore, that's where my entire family went to. So I grew up making thrones out of Zima cases in the back room of the bar, asking the bartenders for Shirley Temples. My grand would keep us amused by giving me like dollar scratch-off tickets, and like I would just play with those. And like I thought that was normal, you know. And as it turns out, most kids never step foot in a bar until they're 21. And I didn't realize that. I thought that was all very normal. Apparently, it's not. So drinking was not like this obscure thing to me. It was actually something that I saw more often than not. As I started drinking more and more frequently, it wasn't hard to hide it. I didn't have to, like, you know, fill up water in like bottles to hide that I had taken it, because nobody noticed that it was gone. Like, there were bottles everywhere. So my dad actually did find a bottle of whiskey in my closet one time, and he kind of sort of asked me in like his very quiet monosyllabic kind of way that he is, and I was just like, oh, that just, you know, ended up there because of such and such, no big deal. And he was just like, okay, and just kind of put it back and left the room. And I think that was the only time I was ever confronted about my drinking. And so as time went on, I discovered, as I was drinking more, like hard liquor, because as a kid, we could have wine coolers whenever we wanted. Like, so my first drink isn't really memorable. We were drinking little bits here and there forever. So as I started drinking more and more like hard liquor, it was usually like whiskey, because that's what we had in the house all the time. By the time I was in my freshman year of high school, I would just take a bottle of whiskey in my backpack to school, and I would empty out a little bit of a Coke that I would get out of the soda machine in the morning, you know, with the $2 that I stole out of my mom's purse in the car. And I would put the whiskey in there, and I would go about my day, and then I wasn't getting, like, blackout drunk as a little kid. But there was something about the effect that it had on me. And I reflect on that sometimes when I think about how I didn't end up with this drug or this thing or this eating disorder or this other thing. And I've noticed that even though I did try just about anything to get out of myself, there was a specific effect that I was looking for. And for me, alcohol, and not like necessarily the blackout drunk alcohol, but alcohol gave me that perfect feeling. I had this constant hum in my head all the time. And when I got sober, people would tell me to think back to when I was a kid and everything was great and I had no problems and everything, like no expectations, and you felt good. And I was like, what? Like, people ever felt good? Like, that didn't make any... So I couldn't reflect on that because I just felt terrible all the time, and I never understood it, and I could never explain it, and like I said, didn't really have anybody to talk to about it. So this drinking just kind of toned that down. For once, I just wasn't feeling like a raw nerve all the time. This thing is really unnerving. I'm like just looking at my chin. but so, you know, I'm a raw nerve all the time, and this dulls that. So, hello. Bearded man just popped up. So as I go along and I discover this secret to just, you know, dulling that down. And, you know, unfortunately, like all man-made things, they eventually fail me. You know, everything runs out, everything breaks, everything dissolves, everything erodes away, and I grew tolerant. So obviously that kind of like adds up and adds up and adds up, and I start drinking more and more. And that's another thing that I reflect on a lot too, where I started and where I ended up. You know, we see people very down and out at their bottom, and it's like, Jesus, like, who wants to live like that? How do you get there? And it's not overnight. You know, so in my progression, you know, what it was like, what happened, you know, as we get there, it's exactly like it's laid out in the big book. It was slow, it was insidious, and it was progressive. As I kind of got into high school, like I said, like with my severe depression, I really didn't have much for goals in life. I didn't really want anything, and it was and it unnerved my mother. She told me multiple times how like freaked out she was by me because I just had no desire for anything ever. We went to Mexico, and I went swimming with dolphins, and like I remember it was a really cool experience. You know, it was a lot of fun, but if you look at the video of me when I was there, it's just like lights are on and nobody's home, just completely blank expression, and that's apparently what I was like all the time. And it was just something that, because we couldn't talk about, I just tried to hide as much as possible. I tried to fit in as much as possible. I tried to pretend. And so as I think I was about 15, 16, I was in ROTC in high school, and my one goal that I had that I thought like could feasibly get me out of my town, get me away from my family, give me something to do, because I didn't want to do anything, I wanted to be a pilot for the Air Force, or Navy, or whatever. And I was in Navy ROTC, and I have a hearing impairment. My hearing is degenerative, and I didn't really talk about it too much because my mom would just tell me things like, you know, try harder, like just try to hear harder, I don't know. You know, if I tried harder, it would have been fine, you know. And obviously, I didn't have anybody else to kind of give me any other feedback other than that, so I would just try and hide it. I would try to pretend. I would try to fit in. I would try to be something else. I would try to make things work, whether they did or not. As long as you thought I was doing well, I was doing well, whether I was or not. And my commander, and I still remember this conversation, and I guarantee you he doesn't. I remember the conversation. I had said something. I didn't hear him, and I was just like, oh, I don't hear very well. And he just looks at me, and he's like, I don't think you can be a pilot if you're deaf. And I was just like, oh. You know, and I did try to get into the military when I turned 18, just generally, and I couldn't even get in. You know, I couldn't even go in as, you know, bullet fodder to go run across the desert. They didn't even want me for that. And I remember hearing that, and I was just like, well, there goes the last of what I wanted to do. So from that point on, I barely went to school. I was actually a pretty smart kid, though, as much as I read. Standardized testing, you know, I was very well trained for standardized testing. If you give me, like, you know, the fill in the bubble kind of thing, I'm good. I don't even have to know anything about it. Although once I got to college and it's fill in the blank instead of fill in the bubble, I was dicked. Wasn't as smart as I thought I was. But so I managed to coast through. I skipped school a lot. I ended up with, you know, older boyfriends with the motorcycle and the house and the estranged wife, as it turns out. You know, just really awful situations, awkward situations. And but it didn't really much matter to me as long as these people kind of kept me in booze, you know, as long as they were the place to go to get away and just drink. And it's part of that slippery slope thing. As things started to progress, that became all I ever cared about. And people that were around me in very short time could tell that was all I cared about. I didn't actually care about anyone around me. I didn't know how. So they would be short-lived friendships, relationships, and I would just kind of bounce from group to group of people all over the place. And I kind of got into this, like, rotation where I would try to get away from my life as much as possible, you know, the geographical change. I would wake up in weird places, weird countries once, and that was just like another day. It still didn't get me far enough away. Life still happened. At one point, I just ended up kind of living in like an old industrial building in D.C. And I had to hide. I did have a beater car that I could drive, and I kind of like hid it around the block because you don't want homeless people knowing you have a car at all. And I ended up just kind of, I was there for like 2 or 3 months, and again, not on accident. I thought that by the time I ended up there, I was like, this is actually kind of nice. I don't have any responsibilities. I don't have any bills. I don't have anyone to account to. You know, I don't have to do anything. I can just sit here and drink. And that's what I did. And, you know, rob houses so that I could sit there and drink. And these two really, like, cracked out guys became my buddies. And, you know, they would help me find the good dumpsters with the good pizzas. And you know, I lived like that for a little while. And one of the guys, he had a it was an infection in his tooth. And his paranoid schizophrenic. Part of the reason why he was there, and he wouldn't go to the hospital, and his infection spread, and he got really sick, and he died one morning. And my other friend, he's just like freaking out, like, what do we do? And I went and got my car, and I went back to my parents, and I was like, I'm sorry, can I come back? You know, I didn't go there for life to happen. I went there to get away from problems, to get away from people, to get away from stuff. And so that was like my detox experiences. I would get away from life for a little bit. It would be a little bit more tolerable. I would go back and then just do it again. I was like that milk carton kid. I would just take off. And so I did end up trying to do a little bit of college. Never lasted very long. I actually ended up in the psych ward 3 years in a row, November. And they were just like, is there something significant about this date? And I'm like, I don't think so. And it just turns out it was like every fall season I would try to go back to school and I would like just freak out. And I would just end up drinking really heavily. And like if I've got like $40, I'm going to spend it on booze. I'm not going to spend it on gas to get to class. I had like a lot of ruses. I would kind of siphon money from my parents. School books, you know, you get your school books, you can take them back to the bookstore. So I'd buy them, he would buy them on his credit card and take them back to the bookstore and I get cash. You know, I had a picture in my phone of a flat tire that I would send periodically to like get some cash for my, and that also helped with avoiding my family as well. I could just be like, oh, I was on my way, but I got a flat tire. Meanwhile, like I'm somewhere I don't even know where and had no intentions of ever going. And everything about my life was a lie. Everything was fake. I ended up squatting in a, it used to be a hair salon, I believe, and I was in the one room in the front, and I think it used to be the office, and it did have a bathroom, but landlords don't really like it when people are just squatting in their buildings, so they eventually cut off the water. And, When I was younger, you couldn't even get me to go camping because there was no running water. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. So now here I am in like the squat, and I got my mattress on the floor. I did have a mini fridge. I thought I was moving up in the world when I got the mini fridge. And I was trying to take a shower with gallon jugs of water that I would siphon out of hoses. And I'm trying to take a shower in the shower, you know, and like guys, I don't know, like some of you have long hair, you might relate, but it's kind of hard to, you know, wash your hair with a gallon jug of water. So my solution was I'm going to cut all my hair off. So I just cut it off really short, made it so much easier. You know, and that made sense to me. I was a problem solver. I was making this work. I could have gone back to my parents at any time. They would have put me up in my old childhood room. They would have paid for me to go to school, but I wouldn't have been able to drink. I would have had to report to them. I would have had to be accountable to someone. Like, my behavior would have been accountable. And, like, I just wasn't okay with that. It wasn't going to work for me. So I did whatever I could to make my situation work as it was. You know, I lowered my standards and my morals to meet my drinking. You know, my drinking escalated, my standard and moral came right down to it. And I was 22, actually I was 21 when I got my first DUI. It was right before Halloween. It was the weekend before Halloween. I was in a naughty nurse outfit. I had stockings, like the fishnet stockings, and knee-high white go-go boots. And I wrecked my car. I was blew over a 0.4. So as you can imagine, I wasn't like very responsive to these police officers telling me I had to go with them. I'm like, absolutely not. So I wasn't their favorite that night. And my dad had to pick me up from the jail that next morning. And the parking lot is not near the door. It's not. You have to do like this walk of shame, like a half mile from the jail. And I'm like just walking to the truck in his go-go boots and that outfit. We haven't talked about that since. Thank God he has not brought that up. And my response to that was to do absolutely nothing. You know, I really thought I wasn't going to go to jail. I thought they were just going to forget about me. Like, anybody ever just like not pay their phone bill because you think they're just going to like miss you? You know, like they don't. And they don't forget about your DUI either. So about a month later, I managed to completely burn what was left of my life to the ground. I had wrecked my car, so I didn't even have a car. I had no license, and still I managed to just completely destroy everything around me. And so Thanksgiving Day, my sister drove me up to Baltimore to have Thanksgiving with my family, and I was just so intoxicated from the night before that I couldn't function. So I went upstairs into one of the kids' rooms, and I went to sleep on one of the beds, and I was just like asleep the whole time. And when I told this story when I first got sober, and this is why I really actually enjoy telling my story, it's because my story changes. You know, what happened in my story, not really, but the way I see it changes. My perspective has changed. And when I told this story for a long time, I told it just like this. I walked into my aunt's house, and everybody looked at me in like this way that made me feel so guilty, and I decided to go to rehab because I wanted to do something great for my family, and I wanted to be a good daughter, and bullshit. like just a bunch of bullshit. What really happened is I walked in there and they looked at me with pity and disgust because I was pitiful and I was disgusting. And I could not stand it. See, the only thing that got me up in the morning on my little mattress to go over to my little mini fridge to get some water in the morning, the only thing that got me up was to do like this little balancing act in my head. Because I would wake up with all this guilt and shame from the night before, the life before, and I would have to reconcile that because that would keep me like just ready to kill myself after like an hour of just thinking about all that stuff. So then, flip to the other side, the only thing that's going to get me out of bed, I'll think about how much better than you I am, how awful this person is, and how much, like, you know, I don't know what the fuck I thought I was. And that's what I would do every day. And I was always over here, I was up here, down here, over here. I was never exactly where I was at. And so when they look at me that way, I just could not stand it. I couldn't take it anymore, and that was just the last straw. I couldn't deal with myself anymore, and I couldn't reconcile it anymore. I wasn't particularly functional when I got that DUI. I didn't always get to the point that I was at 0.4, nearly dead, drunk. But I was able to get a little farther than I should have. And alcohol wasn't working for me anymore. I could not physically put enough booze into my body to stop. So I kind of came to at one point and suddenly, and like I always like to hear the end suddenlies in people's story because I know what that is now. As you can probably tell from the entirety of my story, I don't make good choices. You know, I don't make good decisions. But end suddenly, I made the first good choice that I've ever made in my life and I started calling rehabs. I have no idea why. I did not want to go. I did not want to stop drinking. I had no idea even what rehab was. And I started calling them, and I told my sister on the way home, I was like, I'm going to go to rehab. I'll go to inpatient rehab. And they got me into one, and I had no idea what to expect. It was about 5 hours north up in the mountains in Pennsylvania. I had never been there before, didn't even know how to pronounce the city name. But I know on the way up there, I pulled up the maps in my phone and I found the closest bar to the rehab because I was going to sneak out of the rehab and go to the bar at night. And I didn't know they take your wallet and your ID and all that, and your phone and all that stuff, so it wasn't really going to work anyways. But as I get up there, as it turns out, it's on top of a mountain. The road to it is called Giant's Despair. It was a blizzard because it was November, and I wasn't going anywhere. And I got to that rehab, and that was like the beginning of completely changing my perspective. It gave me a little bit of foundation to stop long enough to get a little bit of clarity. I did end up going to a sober house afterwards. I stayed up there for about 6 years. I stayed there for 6 years. Anyone want to take a guess how long I lasted out of rehab? It was a week. I lasted a week. I did last through New Year's. I didn't manage to not drink for New Year's. I got out Christmas Day, and within a week, I decided that I was going to go have one beer. Just one beer. I'm going to go to one of the bars around the corner and have one beer. And I ended up about 2 hours late for curfew, pissed drunk, kicked out of my sober house, and wandering around the city that I've never been around in my life. I did go to a couple meetings before this, but I didn't speak to anyone. I didn't even listen. I wasn't even really willing. And so I ended up wandering around. And fortunately, there was a couple that owned a different sober house who had recently relapsed. Like, this wasn't common knowledge yet, but they really needed the money. So the next day, they allowed me to move in, even though I wasn't even sober at all yet. And they let me move in, and thank God. You know, thank God for them. And I managed to get 6 months after that. I did get a sponsor. The only reason I got a sponsor is because I did finally take a little bit of suggestion. The first meeting I went to that day after getting into that sober house, I raised my hand. I said, I'm Bobby. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I'm screwing up my life. I need help. And these three girls who are still sober today came up to me and real smiling, real big, you know, looks kind of terrifying, like because they're so happy and they're so happy to see you. And they invite me to go bowling. And I'm like, who goes bowling? I'm like, I don't want to go bowling. But the one was really hot and I kind of wanted to check it out and, you know, scope it out and see what was going on with that. So I went bowling and her roommate came and she ended up giving me a ride home and her roommate ended up being my sponsor. And We did go through the steps, and I lied the whole way through. You know, like, step five, after you're done, you're supposed to, like, take an hour with you and God and all that. I watched TV, you know, but I said I did it. You know, as long as you think I did it, I did it. It's good. Like, the whole idea, I didn't believe that you believed. I believed y'all were fucking delusional. And I had nowhere else to go. Nobody else cared about me. Nobody else loved me until I could love myself. I had nowhere else. So I just kept coming. I just kept coming back. And even though I completely half-assed the entire steps the whole way through, I did get a little tiny bit of peace and serenity. Just a little bit. And I didn't know what I had at the time. I had no idea. I'd never had that before. And so I finished up all the steps. You know, you know how the promises for the nine-step promises? You actually have to do the ninth step to get those promises. So I thought, if you thought I made the amends, it counted. So I just like, yeah, I totally made it this amends. It was great. Like, no. You actually have to follow through with it to get the rewards. And that just, like, went right over my head. And obviously, I drank after a while just because I couldn't live with myself. I hadn't actually gotten any of the promises that are promised in these steps because I didn't do them. I had no higher power, and I really wasn't willing to try. And so when I relapsed, I decided, since I drank and nothing bad happened, that I wasn't an alcoholic anymore. And I went about that like that for about 2 years. And eventually, you know, like all things do, it went right back to the way that it was. It didn't initially, and I thought I was, like, through this. Like, my life was better. I had the relationship. I had the car. I had the job. White picket fence going on. I was going to be getting married. And I was at my bachelorette party, and I was at my parents' apartment in D.C. after the bachelorette party, and I was pretty drunk. And I was standing on the balcony outside of the condo, and the only reason that I didn't throw myself off of it was because I didn't think it was high enough to kill me. And nothing was wrong. My life was great. You know, at least I would have told you that. But inside, I was dying. And that was the moment that I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I did go back to rehab sometime in October. I don't know when. I don't really remember. When I first moved here, somebody asked me what my sober date was, and I was like, oh, October 2015. And she's like, oh, well, what day? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Up north, you celebrate at the end of the month with your home group only. If you don't have a home group, you don't celebrate. They call it homeless. And so we just celebrated at the end of the month. I celebrated every October, and it didn't matter what the day was. And she's like, oh, if you don't have a sober date, are you really sober? I'm like, I feel fucking sober. So I kind of just, like, picked a random date. So, like, this next week I'm actually going to start my 6-year celebration on Monday because that's the most convenient for me. Y'all celebrating every day at every meeting that you go to has really tripped me up. I had to come up with a routine. I didn't want to pick up my chips the first couple, and I didn't. I didn't until the third month. I finally picked up because they made me. I didn't want to do any of the stuff that anybody suggested, but I didn't. I was desperate at that point. Everything had changed. I did everything completely different. I got out of rehab. I called the contact person that they gave me. I went to every meeting that I could find. I got a new sponsor because my previous sponsor had moved away, and I did everything that I could. I worked two jobs, probably like 60, 70 hours a week, and I still went to two meetings a day. Like, I just got it done, and I was really desperate to grow this time. And I did fully do the steps exactly how it is laid out, and I didn't lie. I wanted to a couple times. You know, you get to step five, and I'm reading, and I'm like hopscotching over stuff a little bit. And my sponsor's like, oh, anything else? And I'm like, yes. She's like, okay. And then anything else? Yeah. And then eventually it got out. And everything changed. I finally had that peace and serenity that people had talked about, that thing that they wanted me to remember back to when I was a kid and, you know, have that feeling. And I didn't think that was a thing. I never felt it before. I thought, I didn't understand why people wanted to be sober, because anytime I was sober, I felt like hell. And I didn't understand that you could actually feel different. I didn't get that until I got it. I was monkey see, monkey do. I followed people around. People put me in their pocket, drove me around. And eventually, at doing what these people with a higher power you know, with a God, living sober, doing what they did, got me there, got me enough to have my own experiences. And I truly enjoy this program today. When I go to meetings today, it's because I actually really legitimately like going. And it's not because I need to go to stay sober. It's not because I need to get a sponsee because I only have 10 and I need 20. You know, it's not any of those things. It's because I love it. I genuinely love it. I love the feeling that I get into the room. I love the feeling when people like Brian walk into the room and I'm just like, where are you going tomorrow? And he's like, tomorrow? I was just going to come here next week, you know? And he immediately gets plugged into meetings, and he shows up, and he got here today, and he had a little note sheet so he would know what to say when he spoke. And I'm like, no, we don't use notes. You let God speak through you. And he's like, okay, put it in his back pocket. And there he went. Although, actually, I think he did say, God was with me when I wrote it. But he did immediately follow the suggestion, and we talk about stick around or you'll miss a miracle. I thought that was talking about me, you know, because I'm like, I'm a miracle. Like, you know, y'all are so lucky to have me. I'm a fucking miracle. And that's not what that means. It doesn't mean I'm a miracle, like stick around or I'm going to miss my miracle. Like, I mean, I am pretty miraculous. But it's not talking about that. I didn't believe into this program until I saw people like Brian. When they came in looking like hell, miserable, not knowing what to do, because I couldn't see it in myself, but I can see it in you. And these people got healthier faster than I did. I'm like, fuck them. I got to, like, get on the move. That's the miracle. That's what I like to see, and that's why I keep coming. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Bobby.